One of the best quotes that I've always felt personifies the compassionate nature of America is the one attributed to Lady Liberty. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. I love that. Give me your tired, give me your poor, give me your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. I've always imagined this line being told by the Statue of Liberty to other countries around the world, countries run by dictatorships who have no interest in lifting their people up, or corrupt pseudo-democracies that treat their countries like a slot machine on a sinking boat, trying to cash in as quick as they can before the tide of poverty and ineptitude sweeps over the country and destroys anything an honest man tried to build. The best part of that line is that it never described what that tired, poor person looks like. It doesn't describe where they came from or what religion they follow. They just have to want to be here. Many American nationalists like to point out that America isn't like other countries in that it was never created as a standard nation state. It was created based on a common language or a common religion. It was created based on a common idea or a common set of ideas. The idea was simple. You follow the Constitution and you can do whatever you want. Want to start a business? We will write laws that make it easy for you to grow your business. Want to be a writer? You can write whatever you want. Just don't cause anybody any harm. And don't lie. The rules were more or less along these lines. Things were good. The economy was growing at a fast rate. Slavery helps with that. Then we needed more people, and there came the immigrants. We weren't a colonial power, so everyone was new to America. In came the Irish, the Poles, some Greeks, some Russians later on, and the Germans. Everybody brought something with them, for better or for worse, and as they got to know one another, they adopted each other's goods and bads, until we ultimately kept the good and left the bad. Foreign customs made their way into the American cultural vernacular. Most people don't know this, but our first wave of Muslim immigrants were brought in as slaves from West Africa. Middle Eastern immigration began in the late 1800s with immigrants from Lebanon. In time, we adopted the phrase, Nation of Immigrants. And this was a badge of honor we would wear, a source of pride we would flaunt in front of classical nation states. But that pride today is in short supply. Steve Bannon, Trump's most trusted advisor, was interviewed during his Breitbart days about the state of America as he saw it. He talked about how, at its core, America is a country based on Western values. Nothing odd about that statement, but he added the term Greco-Roman to describe American philosophy at its core, and that certain cultures are incompatible with those values. Any attempt to homogenize those cultures would result in betraying the core American values, because you'd be diluting them with something incompatible. He named the Islamic culture as the top contender for that spot, and this stunned me. As an American Muslim, I saw the story of Muslim integration into America as the same as everyone else's. Keep the good, leave the bad. It may take a few generations, but life is long, and things ultimately work out. But this is the first time I've heard of in American history where nearly every branch of the government is determined to alienate you. Perhaps we could learn from African Americans who fought with dignity all their lives for that piece of the American dream while being served the American nightmare. This is the part that excites me and scares me. We know of the American ideals. We've been taught it all our lives. It's our chance to fight for them. Can American Muslims be the ones to revitalize the American ideals? More calls, please. Gentlemen. It's been a long break. How you guys been?
Doing, surviving.
Great, man,
surviving.
Life is good. Life is good.
Life is good. Bullshit. What's new in the news?
Donald Trump is president.
So what was our last podcast? It was back when the primaries were still going
on.
No,
the last podcast was we covered
the Clinton
debate.
And Trump debates. And we were debating about how well Clinton did,
yeah.
And there was no chance that Trump would win, and
yeah.
Clinton was picking up percentage points,
yeah.
And now we're at a different place.
Ultimately, that analysis failed because the polls didn't matter. Because the voter turnout was
yeah.
completely different than what was expected. People said that they were going to vote for Clinton, and the people who said that outnumbered the people who said they were going to vote for Trump. But those people didn't show up. Or I should say, more of the Trump people showed up. Excuse me. Always got a cough once. So have you guys felt the Trump presidency yet?
I feel it every day.
How so?
It's a lot of stress, a lot of tension, constantly on edge. It's always in the back of your mind, you know.
What's on the back of your mind?
Well, like you mentioned in the intro, you know, it's like the entire government is intent on suppressing you, is sort of trying to alienate you and make you seem like the other. And that's the first time I've ever experienced anything like that.
Any? What about you? You're a big guy. Anybody mess with you?
Not afraid of anyone messing with me on that level, but. Like Hunter said, it's stressful. Like, never before have I had to get up every day and watch the news and catch up on Facebook wondering what happened today. What executive order was signed today? Is he banning people that have a green card? Like, what crazy thing is Trump trying to implement today? So, yeah, it's a constant stress level, and we're only a week into the presidency.
I was just gonna add that it's only been 1 week. Like last Friday, he was not last Friday, or just a little over. It's been like 10 days. You know, and people say that, oh, this is what McCain voters or Romney voters felt like when Obama won the election. No, Obama did not go after the people who voted against him on day one with executive orders. You know, he may have forced them to do something they didn't like healthcare, but that was like 2 years in, or a year in.
And there's no comparison between the two. Like, one is forcing you to get healthcare, which is something that you need, and is helping you in some way. The other is potentially being kicked out of a country or put in a concentration camp or whatever.
Or
I mean,
internment camp.
There's like no comparison between the two.
So, what do you think of his rationale, the security rationale behind the ban? Because that list, those seven countries he got, he inherited that from Obama's foreign policy team, who labeled these seven countries. They didn't talk about a ban.
Yeah.
Obama's people.
So it's bullshit. He loses all credibility on the security argument when he doesn't ban the freaking countries that are a security threat. Like, you can't say I'm doing it for security and then not ban Saudi Arabia, not ban, I'm guessing Pakistan should be thrown in the mix. You know, there's countries that he didn't put on the list that clearly are more of a security threat. Like, there's a meme out there somewhere where there's a list of the countries he banned and there's like zero attacks within the U.S. on U.S. soil from their citizens. And then, like, three or four countries that he didn't ban, and there's, like, hundreds of thousands of American deaths from those citizens. And those just happen to be the countries where he has business dealings. So, is there a security threat? Yeah, probably. I mean, ISIS has come out and said that they're going to embed their people into the Syrian, you know, refugees. They're going to try to sneak people in that way. Okay, yeah, there might be some validity to that argument, but you totally can't even save face when you don't ban certain countries.
What I don't get is their line of logic when they say, or when they cite, like, San Bernardino or Orlando. Those were not foreigners. Those were people born here or raised here who came here legally and were, quote-unquote, radicalized on the internet.
Right.
So it completely defeats the argument. And
the certain San Bernardino, wasn't that a Pakistani couple?
Yeah, who lived here most of their life.
Yeah, but I mean, they're Pakistani descent. Why isn't Pakistan on the ban list?
The pessimist in me, when they bring up those people who are from here, when they cite those examples, I feel like they're building a case.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they're building a case against American Muslims. I see a lot of people justifying the ban, saying, you know, we have legitimate security fears. You know, we're afraid that, you know, we don't know who the good ones and the bad ones are. You know, some of them are going to be bad, so we need to ban them all. And that's a shame, but, you know, it's something that has to happen. It's a necessary evil because these people are trying to kill us. It's very easy to use that exact same justification against American Muslims. It doesn't take a very big leap to jump from one to the other.
Especially when they're getting something they wanted done on one front using an argument they could use on another front.
Right.
Which doesn't apply to immigrant or foreigners or refugees. You know, it could be applied to people like us.
Right. And I also feel like if you look at it, I mean, I was listening to someone on NPR today. They were talking about how this one journalist had interviewed about 20 different intelligence people, and you know, people from CIA, people from the NSA, people from all different branches. And not a single one of them thought that the ban was a good idea from a security standpoint. And a lot of them actually thought it was bad for security, because it obviously feeds into the narrative of ISIS, that America and the West are at war with Islam and not with, you know, just extremists.
Yeah.
And I can't help but think that the administration that's in power right now, I mean, they're not stupid. You know, there are some intelligent people there, and they have access to all the intelligence, you know, all the different branches of the intelligence community. They know this. So then why? What's the point? If they know that it's not going to make us more secure, then what is the point? Mm. And I feel like they're intentionally trying to feed into the ISIS narrative.
So a big part of me believes that pessimistic view. Okay, because it's completely logical. I don't trust their integrity, and I think they want to do this. But what do you think of the argument of just the security side? You know, these are countries where the government is either in a collapsed state or are, you know, in open rebellion against their people, and it's hard to vet them. Is that a legitimate argument, or is that just completely flawed as well?
I agree that it's hard to vet them, but I also think that if you think that there's large numbers of them that are going to be ISIS fighters, I think that's just naive. Everyone knows the vast majority of these people are people who are fleeing ISIS and they're just fleeing war. You know, mm-hmm. their entire lives have come crashing down around them. They're putting their children in boats and in treacherous seas to escape with their lives, hopefully, with a 50-50 chance of making it to the other side. It just tells you how desperate these people are. And there may be, yeah, there probably will be a few who are dangerous among them. But you know what, I'll tell you this. If I was one of those refugees, and there was a country that had heart enough to take me in, and I knew that there was somebody with me who had bad intentions, they would be my worst enemy. It's like, you're trying to harm the people who are saving my life, literally.
And you could potentially ruin it for me.
Exactly. You're going to ruin it for me, and you're going to ruin it for the rest of my family back home, who might have the same opportunity to come to a safe place and build a new life. You know, you're going to ruin it for all of us. So, I mean, the people who are legitimate refugees, which will be the vast majority, are not going to... The terrorists among them are not going to find any support with those people. And those people will turn them in right away as soon as they figure them out.
So I don't mean to give Trump, like, any leeway in this or anything, because we haven't even talked about the disappointment that we all felt, you know, the night of the election. But so these are all campaign pledges that he made. And so the ban that he put, or the travel restriction, however people phrase it, it was temporary, even in the executive order. It was for 120 days. Do you think that it's possible that he was just trying to placate that base?
And that was my initial thought when he asked the question, but my initial thought was maybe he's doing it for a show, just because he said he would do it. At the end of the day, he's just going to help big business. But then you got the Steve Bannons, you got the people around him, that their whole careers and livelihoods are built around, you know, hating Muslims and other minorities. I don't think it's something that he's just doing to placate and then it'll go away. Or he may want to, but his inner circle, the people around him, they don't want that. They want to expand on it.
So analysts have described Trump, even Obama, when he first met Trump after the election, said that he doesn't come across as an ideologue.
He doesn't,
but that is not true one iota of the people around him.
Yeah.
In particular, Steve Bannon, who I quoted earlier, or I didn't quote him, but paraphrased him in an interview, where he talked about the incompatibility between Islamic cultures and what he called Greco-Roman cultures. I thought the use of that term was interesting and kind of frightening, because that, you know, there's no talk anymore of Greco-Roman culture. But in essence, that he's talking about white Western European, not even like Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox Christians. He's talking about Western European white Christians. Does that term, have you heard that term before?
Greco-Roman.
I mean, I've only heard it applied to like a Eurorap or something, the Greco-Roman Eurorap.
Right.
But I think that's odd because that there's something innate, something tribal in that. Does that make sense to you guys?
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely a nationalist, if nothing else.
But something deeper. I mean, he's not an American nationalist. An American nationalist, like, you can become an American, but you can't become Greco-Roman. That's just something in your ancestry.
Right.
And he argues that...
He's a white supremacist.
I mean, he's been called that, right? He's been called that. And he's definitely comfortable around actual self-declared white supremacists, which is alarming in itself. But let's give him that. He never calls himself that. But the fact that he referred to this Greco-Roman ancestry as being incompatible with an Islamic ancestry. So he's essentially written off, you know, 1.5 billion people as saying that they're innately incompatible, regardless of how close to their religion they are, or how conservative or orthodox they are in their religion. But that the cultural norms that are linked to Islamic culture are inherently incompatible with those of Greco-Roman ancestry. That just struck me. I mean, I'm surprised.
It's so, like, Republicans love to say un-American, but what's more un-American than that? Like, America's built on taking in all sorts of cultures, all sorts of religion, all sorts of people, and creating this melting pot. But what he's saying is, no, certain ingredients just are incompatible with our melting pot. And in fact, he doesn't even want a melting pot. I mean, he just wants a bunch of white people.
Right, because people of Greco-Roman ancestry.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I would like for someone to bring up, like, African-Americans. How they've always been a part of America, yet shunned the...
Yeah. That's a very good point.
Right.
They're definitely not Greco-Roman.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
But they are,
but what they
100% a part of America. Any white person who says that black people are not part of America is full of shit. So, that kind of goes against... I mean,
yeah.
It shows that he's not really including minorities in his vision of America.
And his view of Muslims, by and large, it's just so narrow in that he's, you know, Islamic culture is one thing to him. But, you know, Indonesians and Iranians have nothing in common. Like, their language is completely different. Their ancestry is completely different. I don't think they probably had any historical interaction. The food is different. Like, everything is different. Yet somehow they all fall under this umbrella. I mean, so when they say, like Western culture, what does Western culture mean to you?
White people culture.
White people, right? Or the culture itself as a set of ideals. What does it mean to you? Like, have you ever even had to think about it? Like, I can tell you, as I learned about these things, that's why I know about them.
I mean, I would think, you know, things like the principles that we consider the principles, the founding principles of the United States, you know, like the freedoms that we have in this country are basically the prime example of Western.
So what I think Steve Bannon thinks it is, it boils down to individualism, the emphasis on the individual and the individual's rights, as opposed to the Islamic perspective, which is communal rights. I don't see those two different ways of thinking as so inherently in conflict that a person can't live productive life, you know, while in their heart subscribing to, like, to communal-based views and living in a society that values individualism. I mean, to me, it just strikes as the perfect balance. Because one doesn't have all the answers to happiness, and the other doesn't have all the answers to happiness. But a blend of the two seems like if a person can mentally balance that, does that make sense?
I'm not sure what you mean by the communal.
So Islamic culture, as described by Western intellectuals, has often been, it's desert based, right? And desert always means you take care of the tribe. Like, desert based cultures, are more into taking care of one another as opposed to looking out for the individual rights. That's a concept that came like much later on. Because of the rugged nature of life in the desert, so this philosophy of the group being more important than the individual. At its core, that's what Islamic culture is. Or at least that's all I can think of that Steve Bannon would know about. Okay, I'll give you an example of individual rights. Okay. Dating is an individual right. Yet it's the practice that's shunned in Islamic cultures. Or even the way it's done is just completely different. It's more communal. It involves everyone. It involves the families. So stuff like that can branch out into other fields where the issue can have repercussions to where it becomes incompatible with living in Western culture. So, for example, if you want to do it in America, you should be allowed to. And no one is going to support the idea of your community coming down on you for practicing that individual right. And so it being even an issue in America is something that Americans aren't used to hearing. A community preventing one of its members. Like, imagine if a mosque here came down and just stopped someone from dating someone. Now that's unheard of, because it's like...
Well, that may be unheard of, but a community coming down on people for using birth control or for trying to get an abortion or for being gay or transgender,
yeah.
Those certainly exist in the United States.
Right. So this is what I see that people like Steve Bannon don't get, the nuance of this issue of incompatibility between the two cultures. Is this too wonky, or does it make sense?
A little above my head, I think.
But the problem is, like, people like Steve Bannon think this way, but they don't think in a nuanced way.
I don't think anybody's debating that Bannon doesn't think in a nuanced way.
Yeah.
I mean, to be at that level of bigotry, you're not very nuanced.
No,
you've seen the world very black and white.
Right, which is what he does, right? But he's gained an audience, or he's gained a platform through the president.
Do you think he's just power hungry and he needs a boogeyman to keep that power, and they're just turning Muslims into that boogeyman?
I don't think so.
I don't think it just happens to be Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's necessarily power hungry. I think that he's an ideologue.
Yeah.
I think this is what he really believes in. He's trying to...
Well, if, let's say, 9/11 didn't happen, let's say some of these terrorist attacks didn't happen, do you think instead that he would have just turned that towards black people, towards homosexuals, towards whoever is convenient for that?
For the same reason that I listed, like, the incompatibility of the cultures, he would still have an issue with it. He just
wouldn't be able
to get
down. Well, that's the bullshit that he's spewing, but would he make blanket arguments against other groups if he felt like that would be more successful?
No, because he sees, like, East Asians as having a compatible culture, in the sense that, you know, if someone actually brought this up to him and asked him about East Asians, I would think he would just let them slide.
Talking about Chinese people.
Yeah, Chinese, Japanese, Southeast Asian.
Okay.
He would say that they don't cause trouble. That whatever their cultural norms are, haven't gotten in the way of freedom, for lack of a better term, here.
And how have Muslims gotten in the way of freedom in the United States?
So... They always cite Europe first, okay?
Yeah.
And then they talk about the United States as being, you know, we need to stop it before it happens here. So I'll give you an example of one of the things they talk about in Europe. So the type of Muslims that Europe gets, so like Britain, for example, they always had a relationship with their former colonies, Pakistan and India being some of them. So it's easy for people in Pakistan to get a green card to come to England. They have labor needs. People have been immigrating there, you know, like 100 years back or 80, 90 years back. So there are certain areas in England where it's predominantly Muslim or predominantly Pakistani, and they're very culturally conservative. They'll come from villages, small towns, they don't come in for education purposes or work purposes. So their mindset is very similar to what it is in the villages in Pakistan. Very conservative, very tribal. So there was like a small movement in like Birmingham or somewhere where they were trying to ban the sale of alcohol. Okay. Now, individual rights, versus communal demands. Okay? The community there didn't want this individual right to be practiced. They are in enough of a majority there in Birmingham to where they can pass something like that. But it goes against individual rights. And alcohol is, you know, and it's just seen as something that's not worth debating. If you want to drink, you can drink.
There's dry counties throughout the U.S. There are dry counties in Texas.
Right. So, Birmingham is not a dry county. But they want to make it a dry county.
Right.
So the locals, or I should say, the non-immigrants,
mm-hmm.
are having an issue with that. So people here point to stuff like that and say, see, they're trying to change the culture there.
But who wanted to make a non-alcoholic the county? Was it Muslims in Birmingham?
Yeah.
So there's enough Muslims in Birmingham, Alabama.
You're talking about England.
Birmingham, England.
Oh. I don't think there's a single Muslim in Birmingham, Alabama.
Can we edit that part?
No.
Shit.
It's too good.
You need to lighten
up. I'm going to go back to being quiet.
Birmingham, England. Does it make sense now?
That's why I'm not talking, man. Yeah, Birmingham is I don't know, it's mostly Muslim. It's the majority Muslim.
I don't know if it's majority, but there's a lot of Muslims.
If not, mm-hmm. it's pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
enough to where they're causing a ruckus because of... So, and the English see this as they're bringing parts of their culture that aren't compatible with our culture. So people like Steve Bannon see that happening in England and in Germany and
mm-hmm.
Italy and France with the face veil and stuff. And they say, look, we need to stop that from happening here. Like, we need to nip it in the bud before it even becomes an issue. And I think they see people, they see liberals, and they say, these guys don't know what they're talking about. And that if they knew what Muslims really were like, and what they really want, that they would be on our side. So we need to nip this in the bud, stop the flow of refugees, because they're oftentimes poor. Not always. Some are very wealthy. Does that make sense? Like, do you... It paints a broader picture, right, as to what is in their mind.
Yeah.
And then you have people...
I just feel like the Republicans have missed a huge opportunity, because when you talk about Christian values and Muslim values, they're the same. They're so similar. When you talk about conservative Muslims and conservative Christians, they have almost identical viewpoints on drinking, on alcohol, on premarital sex, on, you know, these are all things that they actually agree on for the most part.
I think
but
conservative Christians, like that term, there aren't as many as we think. Like the term evangelical,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean what it's supposed to mean. It's just people who are tribal now. There are some deeply religious people that I know personally who voted Republican all their life. Like, I knew them in college. They're Republican. But they see Trump and they say, this is not conservatism. This is not Christian. This is not Christianity.
And those are the people that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know, those Christians have a lot in common with Muslims.
And I think because of Trump, they're seeing that now. Like, the refugee ban, they're totally not for that.
Yeah.
But then there's the other side of that group or that voter base that's just tribal. And I think in this case there was enough of them to get excited about Trump to make him win the election, despite losing the popular vote.
I agree with the tribal aspect of it, but I wouldn't separate them from their religion either. You know, like, I know people who are very evangelical Christians who are very religious and support Trump 100%.
I mean, do they cite like religious convictions?
I've heard them refer to Donald Trump as the anointed one.
No, so I see those people as tribal as well. Like, they're just like pseudo Christian who just...
I don't think
really
they're pseudo Christian. I mean, I know someone who's a pastor,
mm-hmm.
a youth pastor, who says things like this, and on Facebook he's always putting up, you know, Donald Trump quotes and, you know, 100% behind Donald Trump.
So people say this about Muslims, right? Like, they're very conservative, yet they follow these jihadist people. It's the most conservative ones. Yet we know, like, there's a set of principles that if you violate, you're outside the norms of this religion. I think Christians feel the same way about their religion, and oftentimes, I don't know if you agree, these evangelicals go outside the norms of the faith, and it's not Christ-like anymore.
I don't think that the people who support Trump that are very religious evangelical Christians see it that way.
Okay.
But I agree that there are a lot of evangelicals who do see it that way and don't support Trump for that reason.
Who they see the others as gone,
yeah,
outside,
I mean,
the boundaries.
You're right, there are some. I mean, there's even, there was a radio show host that was interviewed on NPR, very conservative evangelical pastor, who was just, they interviewed him and he was expressing how baffled he was that all these people that call into his show are supporting Trump, all these Christians. He's like, I don't understand it. He doesn't stand for anything that Christians stand for. He's not a conservative. He's definitely not a religious person. He just couldn't understand it. And I don't understand it personally from the outside looking in, but there definitely are a lot of religious evangelical Christians who support Trump 100%.
Yeah.
And they don't see any conflict with their religion in it.
I think at the end of the day, those evangelical Christians are just going to support the Republican Party no matter who the candidate is.
Yeah.
The candidate doesn't have to be...
I mean, that I get to an extent, but the ones who are really gung-ho about Trump specifically, that's the part I don't get.
Yeah.
You're talking about somebody who admits to sexually assaulting women, you know, someone who's just crass, arrogant, all about money, greed, wealth, like all the things that Jesus was against.
Yeah, who personifies the exact opposite.
Yeah. He's like literally the opposite of Jesus.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and they're gung-ho about it. Like, I could get like, okay, you know what? He's a flawed person and, you know, I don't really respect everything he has to say, but, you know, he's going to help us stop abortions, which are evil. You know, he's going to stop, you know, Muslim extremism, which I'm sure they probably see that as an evil. I mean, that is an evil, you know. So they kind of get behind him because of those things. But being like gung-ho about him and calling him the anointed one and just constantly posting his speeches and stuff, that I don't understand. I don't see how it's compatible with their faith.
You know, we always talk about cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on nowadays.
Yeah. It's not even a disorder anymore. It's just... It's called
talk about cognitive dissonance. What's his name? Sean Spicer?
Oh, God.
Sean Spicer?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I saw this clip today.
Press secretary.
He's sitting there talking about... All he does is lie all day long and blame the media for lying, but he, like, contradicts himself left and right. Today I saw this clip. He's arguing with reporters who are asking him questions about the ban, and he keeps saying, it's not a ban. It's not a ban. It's not a ban. Well, somebody... took clips of, well, there was a tweet that Donald Trump tweeted like a week ago. It said the ban is, you know, blah, 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 blah. He called it a ban. It's like, well, he was just, and then somebody asked Sean Spicer, why did the president use it in the tweet if it's not a ban? He said, well, he's just using the word that the media is using. Like, well, if you disagree with that word, then why are you using it? Leave that aside. Okay, then there's a clip of Sean Spicer in an interview calling it a ban like 3 days ago. And then the guy who was like showing these clips or whatever goes, so maybe that's what he thought 3 days ago. You wouldn't think that he would have said it again after that. Of course, now he's solidified that it's not a ban. Then he shows a clip from last night. And he said today that it's not a ban. Last night he had an interview and he called it a ban. And now he's sitting there arguing that it's not a ban. Talk about cognitive dissonance, man.
You know, I always try, like, you know, you guys know me personally. Now I've become like this, or become more like this. I'm very partisan now, right?
Yeah.
In my mind, I try to give Republicans the benefit of the doubt. I give them a chance. I give Paul Ryan a chance for years. I always thought, like, when he became Speaker of the House, I was like, you know what? He's young. I think he's going to see through the ideology. He's going to be he'll be solutions oriented. Every time I give them the benefit of the doubt, they let me down. It's that party. What is it, like, win at all costs, lie if you have to, cheat if you have to, gerrymander, do whatever. But, yeah, is it their donors that they're trying to? I mean, their base isn't even that big. So why? I mean, I know...
Well, obviously their base is pretty big. I mean, they control all three
government
now.
The Electoral College, you know... I want to say, like, on a technicality, he won. Got it. he got extra votes.
They didn't win the House on a technicality.
Yeah,
they didn't win
the House
Senate
or Senate on a technicality.
That's true. That's true. Well,
you can't say it's based, the Republican Party base is small.
No, no, I'm not saying it's small.
Living in Texas,
they
you
don't,
can't say
it. No, no,
come
no.
On.
I'm not saying it's small. If I said small, I take that back. It's not as big as they think it is. It didn't give them the mandate that they think it is. And if they didn't gerrymander all the districts, they would not be winning the House. Because,
true.
Because every 2 years when they do the popular count vote, Democrats always in the House have a majority. But because they redrew the districts in a way favorable to them, they end up getting keeping the House.
Speaking of 2 years, that's what we need to, that's what Democrats need to think of. They, and Muslims especially, need to think of, you know, this is just a temporary 2 year thing. We need to do everything that we possibly can to win back the House in 1 year, 11 months,
so the
and 3 weeks.
The last time this happened where they controlled both the legislative and the executive was the election after 9/11, 2004. Then they lost it in 2006. They lost it really quickly. Or it was like they had the Senate but not the House in 2000. Then 2002 came, and they won the House. Or they won the Senate, whatever. And then they had all three. Okay? So 2006 came, they lost the House and the Senate. 2008 came, and they lost the White House, and their margins grew in the House and the Senate. So I don't know, like, I always get disappointed in Democrats, too. It always feels like they're not doing enough.
They're not.
Or they're missing opportunities, but
they are.
But I think the cyclical nature of electoral politics is more of an influence than a lot of the groundwork that these parties put into. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, even if we do win back the... that's for Casey. Even if we do win back the Congress in the next election, I agree. Part of the effect that'll make that happen is not even in anyone's control. It's not about popular movements. It's just about people getting fed up.
Yeah.
Most people vote because they're pissed off. You know what I mean? So whenever you have,
and I hope people stay pissed off.
Well, see, the thing is, nobody, not everyone is going to have everything work out for them in 2 years, you know, with the Republicans. And a lot of people that went Republican, you know, weren't necessarily, especially in the presidential election, weren't necessarily Republicans.
Right.
You know, not traditional Republicans. They were just people who, you know, wanted jobs. You know, I'm not letting Trump voters off the hook 100% because they voted for, like, an open fascist. But the primary reason that they voted for that fascist was jobs. Now, if they start to see that the economy doesn't improve, their jobs aren't coming back, well, they're going to be like, hey, you know what? You guys have no excuses.
Yeah. Yeah.
You control both houses. You control the White House. You control the Supreme Court. If you can't get it done with all that, then we're going the other way. I mean, that's only natural. And it's only natural that a lot of those people will not get their jobs back in 2 years.
You know, there's
2 years is a long time to not have a job.
Yeah.
So by then they're going to be pretty pissed off.
And Republicans are all about cutting unemployment benefits.
Yep.
They're bound to disappoint on some of their promises. And like the whole Justice Democrats movement with Bernie and the Young Turks guy, whatever his name is.
Cenk Uygur.
Yeah. They need to, and they're doing the right thing at a grassroots level. They need to organize now, get people worked up, get people pissed off. To where in 2 years, when the primary or when the whatever Congress elections happen, and what are they called?
Midterm.
And the midterms happen, everyone needs to be hyped up and ready to go and vote for them, which never happens. People are never excited about it. People never show up, which is why the Republicans.
Well,
you
no,
know,
I give you the example of 2004 and 2006.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I personally have never gotten excited or worked up over a midterm. I've never, I don't think, voted in a midterm election. But you better believe it 2 years from now when those elections happen that I'm going to try to get out and try to get other people to go out as well and at least win back Congress. And then in 4 years, we'll worry about the presidency at that point.
Yeah. If there's one silver lining to what's going on right now, it's that it's going to galvanize the opposition.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and I said that before, I don't know if I said it in the podcast, but I've said it before the election, like, if Trump wins, that would be the one positive thing that comes out of it, is that people are going to be so fed up with this guy from all different walks of life. You know, people talk about Obama's trying to divide people. Obviously, Trump is the one who's being divisive. And you're going to see all these people from all different walks of life, Muslims, Jews, Christians, gay, transgender, every single different category of people are going to get together and form one giant group and take him down. I mean, vote him out. You
that
know,
needs
hopefully
to start
vote
in,
out the Congress as well.
Yeah,
the
start in
Congress.
2 years.
You know, I'm reminded of the fact that he won Wisconsin by 10,000 votes. That's not going to happen again. There are not enough.
I think some states he won by like hundreds of votes, like the I don't know if it's Vermont or what, where they were showing it at one point, and he was barely. Some state on the East Coast, that was a small state. At some point, he was up by like 70 votes or something like that.
Well, Hillary Clinton won New Hampshire by 1,500 votes, which is also pathetic. So, I mean, you were talking about how you know, not all Trump supporters are like this, or they have some legitimate concerns. You know, there is like this movement within the left wing to soften people's attitudes towards Trump supporters, because not all of them were racist or whatever. And that's true. Not all of them are racist. But the way I see it, we shouldn't let these people off the hook. They made a terrible choice. They were presented with this. One guy said, you know, let's look at their condition. They were hurting. They, you know, some of them had to work two jobs to make ends meet. And that's, you know, that's not a comfortable life. But they were living. You know, the kids had to move back in with their parents. They had to whatever, they were surviving, okay? They weren't saving a lot of money, but they were living, okay? One guy comes along and says, I'll make your life easier. I'll make it so that you don't have to work two jobs. You can work one job. You can make just as much money. I'm not going to tell you how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it for you. But I'm going to harass black people, Mexicans, and Muslims. So while this person is going to, or he's told he's going to gain personally, he knows that it comes at the expense of these three groups of people. Yet, they made this choice. So what does that say about them? They can tell me that, no, I didn't mean for that. No, I don't want anything bad to happen to your family. But you let it happen. He told you he was going to do it. And he's doing it. He's doing exactly what he said. So, you know, I'm not going to yell at these people, but they knew what was coming.
Oh, yeah, and I said that I wasn't letting them off the hook. They voted for an open fascist.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking the other day in our little group chat about how, you know, what the world needs now is Jon Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very disheartened to see this little interview that he did recently where he said, you know, liberals are always talking about how, you know, we shouldn't see groups as a monolith, you know. So you shouldn't paint all Muslims with the same brush. You shouldn't paint all conservative Christians with the same brush, or all gay people with the same brush, or all black people, or Mexicans.
And we're about to call out Jon Stewart.
What's that?
And we're about to call out Jon Stewart.
Oh, I'm going
to
call him out. I was very disheartened. I was like, this is the man we need right now. And now I'm convinced that he is not on the same page as. Well, he said, you know, we shouldn't see Trump voters as a monolith. And he compared that to painting all Muslims with one brush. Well, excuse me, but all Muslims didn't vote for ISIS.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Then you might have a comparison. You know, if all Muslims were supporting ISIS,
yeah,
and Trump voters were voting for Trump, it's like, hey, you know what? Not all Muslims are the same. Not all Trump voters are the same.
ISIS promised them jobs.
they are the same in that they voted for a fascist who said that he was going to be oppressive, who said he was going to ban Muslims, who called Mexicans rapists and drug dealers. Had no problem with that whatsoever when they did it. So, excuse me, but yeah, I will see them as a monolith.
I see, like, the rural white voter. I see them as a little confused about the way the world is now. Like, you remember that that hashtag was trending, like, hashtag white privilege? Okay. So a lot of these people in the Midwest are not, like, they don't live in major cities. They're not culturally integrated. They don't have black friends. They don't have Mexican friends. They're just close to their family, and that's about it. So they don't understand this idea of privilege, because they haven't seen with their own eyes discrimination. you know, in their eyes, everybody's poor, or everybody's lower middle class, everybody's struggling. So, on the you know, on Facebook and Twitter and stuff, they saw this and they saw it as an attack on them, and so this was their reaction to go with the guy that's most like them or that talks about them or highlights their needs, mm-hmm. as opposed to people like us or me at least, who was, you know, who's retweeting or sharing Facebook statuses that showed white people getting benefits and their privilege coming into play. So a part of me like felt bad after the election when they started apologizing and all that. I had to do it. I thought that maybe they were sensitive to that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like they saw everyone getting condescending to them, getting snooty towards them.
No, I mean, I definitely see where you're coming from. I mean, and you addressed it before too, where it's like, you know, somebody comes along and said, I'm going to make your life easier. I understand. People are humans. We're all humans here. You know, we all make mistakes. You know, and I believe in the concept of repentance and, you know, changing one's mind. And if somebody, you know, was weak and voted for Trump for those other reasons, you know, kind of ignoring the bad things that might happen, and now says, you know what, I made a mistake, I should not have voted for him, hey, you're cool. I have no problem with that person whatsoever, because now they understand. They've gotten it. And in my mind, that's their way of making amends for it, you know. But if they are unapologetically still supporting Trump and what he's doing, then they're still supporting a fascist.
Yeah.
And I'm not okay with that.
So his approval ratings right now are in the negatives. Or a negative of...
Majority 50%. Disapproval.
Yeah, 40%.
The fastest in history
to
reach a majority disapproval rating. Fastest
so
president.
Do you read that and say, like, do you understand now?
No. Because the majority of people didn't vote for him.
Right. Well...
His approval rating based on his votes should be like 25%.
He had 3 million fewer votes than Hillary Clinton.
That's the popular vote. But like
are you saying that this study is done based on the Electoral College, how it would have turned out?
No, no, it's based on like a sampling. Well, actually, no, you're right. Never mind.
So 25% of people in the U.S. voted for him. And as of today, 40% approve of him. Right?
No,
that's what it breaks down to.
It's like 47% voted for him, 48%.
No, you're talking about like
people
eligible
who voted.
Voters or people that voted, whatever. I'm talking about the U.S. population.
Yeah, you know, that's
like 25% of the U.S. population
I see.
Voted for him, 40% of the U.S. population still approves of him. Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
it's kind of hard to draw a comparison
if you just go by like the actual number of.
Yeah.
People that voted for him versus the percentage of voters that voted for him, then you can kind of see how the shift has happened. Like if he got 47% of the votes and his approval ratings at 40% now by the popular count, I mean, that's a pretty drastic drop in a couple months, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Really, it's going to come down to those same three states that flipped. Because when I was looking at I felt like such a fool afterwards. After the election, because I thought I had it down, just because I compared the maps from the previous elections and the likelihood of the Democratic nominee winning the states that Democrats typically always win.
But looking at it post-mortem, going back hindsight 2020, it's not surprising. I mean, Hillary didn't visit one or two of those states. Those states were filled with middle-class, struggling white voters. And Hillary was all about status quo. Everything's okay.
She
the house isn't burning down.
She visited the
some
states.
Of the states she didn't visit.
She visited like Wisconsin, but only the major cities.
There
only
was
the,
one state where
place.
On election night they were saying that Hillary didn't even visit there. I forgot which state it was.
No. It was they were probably talking about certain counties that had voted overwhelmingly for Obama.
No, I remember
visit.
Specifically a specific state that they were saying that she didn't visit, but. Okay, maybe she visited some.
In any case, she showed some neglect in areas.
Absolutely, man.
She showed cockiness, and she wasn't the populist candidate they were looking for. She wasn't the jobs candidate they were looking for. She was a status quo candidate.
They needed some Bernie Sanders.
If they had Bernie Sanders, all those people would have went for him.
Yeah.
The same people that voted for Obama would have voted for Bernie Sanders, the same counties. But she wasn't offering what they were looking for.
So what do you think? What kind of opposition do you think? Because I mean, I don't think it would have been like a walk in the park for Bernie. Just like it wasn't.
I think
a walk
it
in
would
the
have, because he would have gotten all of the Democratic vote that he got anyways, and he would have stolen some of that Trump, you know,
yep.
disenfranchised, mm-hmm. whatever, you know, people that felt like they were being ignored. He would have gotten some of that too.
You don't think the argument would be more potent that government doesn't solve problems and that Bernie is all about government?
Well, that's your
those
traditional
Republicans that believe that did vote for Trump and will vote for Trump. We're not talking about those.
So, like, what argument
he
did
would,
Bernie make that
he,
Hillary didn't make?
He was against the TPP. Hillary was meh. Who knows what the
he's
hell she was
for increasing the minimum wage.
He was
there's
for
a lot
workers.
Of things
he
that
was
he was
for.
She was for that.
Like,
too.
If you talk about reluctantly, he's the one who pushed her there, and then she went and said that she has her public and private opinions. I know you have your thing about that, but I mean, he truly is a working man's candidate.
Yeah,
he really is. He always has been. Look at who his donors are. It's all unions, and all those people in Wisconsin, Michigan that went to Trump, they're all union people. Those are his people. You know,
yeah,
they went
I
for
mean,
Trump because
yeah.
of jobs, and those people all would have gone for Bernie.
And those states in the primaries overwhelmingly went to Bernie.
Yep. Naturally, he was the candidate they were looking for.
Well, one thing that also frustrated me was the insistence of purity from the candidates from third party voters. It's like because I still see them on Facebook and stuff justifying their vote. It's like, man, really, like.
Oh, I saw you having a little spat with a few people.
Yeah.
So
I see third party voters as like cousins who let you down. It's like, dude, if you just stayed in line, we wouldn't be in this mess. Yeah, we would have, like, a flawed, imperfect candidate, but, like, so tell me, what do you think is the difference between, like, Hillary Clinton and John Kerry? Like, John Kerry was the candidate at a time when George Bush, like, set the house on fire. You know, so we didn't nitpick about these things about John Kerry. Oh, he was for this, now he was against it. Whatever, he's not Bush, get it done. But we weren't like that with Hillary Clinton.
Well, because there was no Bush, we had Obama, and they had
no.
they had the luxury of nitpicking. We weren't coming off a Bush presidency.
But I think a potential Trump presidency.
I guess they didn't take it seriously.
Far
enough,
more frightening.
I agree.
Yeah.
But if they bring it up and try to tell me, hey, well, we should have gone for it, you know. Then I'll be like, you know what, shut up. It's because of people like you that we have Trump, you know. But I'm not gonna bring it up, you know, because I don't want to be decisive at this time. Obviously, I'm not going to say not all third-party people wanted Trump to be president. A lot of Johnson supporters wanted Trump to be president over Hillary. But at this point, it's just a matter of, you know, that we need those people just as much as they need us, you know. So...
Any last thoughts before we wrap this up?
We need to continue to stay pissed off, continue to stay vigilant, continue to try to hold Trump accountable, and look forward to 2 years from now. Vote in the midterms, vote in the midterms, vote in the midterms.
I just want to say this, just in case, I don't think anybody ever listens to our podcast. But if you're out there,
if you exist,
and you're a Trump supporter, and you support this Muslim ban, I know you don't think it's a Muslim ban. It is a Muslim ban. You don't have to believe me. You can go ask Rudy Giuliani about it. But if your justification is that, hey, there's some bad ones among them, we don't know who they are, we don't want to get hurt, so we're going to ban them all, mark my words... You are going to use that same justification to allow your fellow Americans to be thrown in camps. And that is morally reprehensible, just as morally reprehensible as it is for you to use it right now. But then you'll be doing it against your countrymen. So just remember that whenever things get worse, and I hope to God, I pray to God that they don't, but I kind of feel like they will, keep that in the back of your mind.
Let me ask a question. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but and I know we're trying to wrap it up, but at the end of the day, do you think the majority of Americans, 99% of Americans, give a shit.
About?
Muslims. It's 1% of the population. Do you think their primary concern when they wake up every morning is what's going to happen to Anwar down the street? Is he going to go in a camp?
Of course it's not.
No, they don't give a shit about that. That's not their primary concern in their lives. A few of them might care, some of them might, a couple might go out to protest, but at the end of the day, the vast majority of them, I don't think that's...
You think it's just something to live with?
Like if I think they can live with it.
We have history as our example.
Yeah.
It has happened.
We come down on Germany and, hey, they weren't killing the Japanese American citizens in this country, but they were putting them in camps. And, you know, we go after Germany for the Holocaust, and yeah, that was much worse than what America did, but America didn't do something very good either. It happened in Germany. All the people let it happen because they were a minority, and they said, hey, you know what? They came for them. We didn't say anything. And the people who were the right color and the right ancestry, you know, were lucky enough to not be affected by it. And the same happened here in America with the Japanese and the internment in World War II. It'll happen again. I mean, just look at history. People are still people.
I think at the end of the day, we need to... I don't know if I'm going to articulate this well enough, but we need to not think of ourselves as more... I think Harun Mogul said something about this as well at some point, but we need to not think that we're more important than we actually are. We're 1% of the population. Not everybody really cares that much. If we want to win back the Democrat, if we want to win back Congress, win back White House, we need to focus on things that appeal to more people. So yeah, Muslim part's important. It's a small part. Most people don't give a shit, in my opinion. We need to focus on jobs. We need to focus on how Trump is not a Christian candidate. You know, you need to focus on those kind of like bigger issues that might appeal.
Reza Aslan said this to me. Or he said it to a crowd that I was in.
Man,
but
yeah, he called me the other day. He said it to me.
He's like, I want to tell you something.
He texted me. No wait, it was just an article.
But it felt like he was talking to me. Anyway, that you know, Muslim Awareness Week isn't gonna, or Islamic Awareness Week that MSA's put on college campuses isn't gonna get them on our side. By telling them that, you know, we believe in Jesus too. That's not gonna win people over. What's gonna win them over is that when our work involves their well-being, when our efforts affect them, then it's like we're the ones that stand up for them. So then they have a reason to stand up for us.
Exactly. We need to convince the Republican poor that they're voting against their interest. Convince them people like Bernie Sanders are actually better for them. You know, just appeal to more broad issues. Yeah. Don't walk around with this, I'm Muslim, I'm being persecuted, you guys need to... I don't think that's the path to victory in politics.
So yeah, I mean, I agree with you. That's what our candidates need to appeal to. And on our side, yes, we need to point out that injustices are being done to us. But like I said about galvanizing all different segments of the population, we have to be out there if they come after women's rights.
Yeah.
We have to be out there if they come after gay rights.
Yeah.
We have to come out there if they go against Mexican immigrants, undocumented immigrants. We have to be there for them. If we're not there for them, why would they be there for us?
Yeah.
And there's not enough in any one of those groups to make an impact on their own.
But when we all combine...
It has to be an aggregate of those groups together.
Well, keep in mind, I mean, there is an argument of civil rights that we have that personally affects us. And that...
Nobody gives a shit, man.
No,
not enough people
as,
give a shit.
As a broader theme, I think...
About Muslims,
civil
rights?
Not just about Muslims.
Not just about Muslims.
If it affects... enough groups.
Yeah, I mean, it's a common theme.
But you have to combine all of
them. So here's an example that I would give. Let's say tomorrow Trump says Muslim women can't wear a hijab. Fuck it. Don't worry about that as a major issue to like go on and on for weeks about.
No.
Focus on if he says something like he's trying to do right now, where he's trying to suppress free speech in the media. Focus on the issue that has a broader impact that you can get more people on your side for.
Religious freedom has broader impact?
I'm just saying, I think going for the broader issues would have more of an impact.
Religious freedom is a broad issue.
It's very
religious freedom when it comes to Muslims that are 1% of the population being persecuted, I don't think would have as broad of an impact as freedom of speech. I mean, that's my opinion.
I disagree with part of that. I mean, I think.
I mean, I don't know. It's hard to say which one is more, which one is less. They're both huge issues.
If I'm a middle-aged white guy and Anwar over here can't wear his dopey, but my local newspaper can't print an article because they're afraid of getting sued for libel, which one are they going
to
care more about?
This. Steve Bannon said that the press is the opposition party of the administration, and that you still have almost half of America that supports him and his administration.
40%, all-time low, hopefully continuing to go down.
Yeah. But you have a lot of people in this country who support him, even though he said, and they support that specific statement.
Yeah.
They are for getting rid of freedom of the press. So you can't just, I mean, yes, you have to fight against multiple issues. But that doesn't mean that I think you can't really say one is more important than the other. It's hard to say which is the most important issue. You have to fight them all. And you have to fight them even if they don't, especially if they don't affect you, I think. You have to be across the board against everything he does.
So
you have
yes,
to unite with other people who are affected by things.
You can't ignore the Muslim issues. Fight those, argue for them, whatever. But fight the other ones too.
Yeah.
Fight the other ones that have, especially the ones that have a broad appeal, that have the biggest impact.
Yeah.
Focus on those also.
So I guess my takeaway is, there is this altering of the American identity, or I should say, perhaps it's sharpening at the edges. What is American and what is not? When it used to be, America was everything. You know, everyone, every shape and size and color from all over the world comes here, and over time it becomes something grander, the American identity. It becomes all colors, all languages, all religions. Find that, the average American should find that ideal inside them, and it should be important to them that we remain culturally diverse, that we remain religiously diverse, and not allow this false sense of economic security trump all of these other issues that made us great, or make America great, for lack of a better term. So I guess that's it.
Just a quick point to emphasize that. If I'm a middle, let's say I'm a 25-year-old white guy living in Wisconsin, and there's two things that I'm looking at. One is the issue of Syrian refugees that has zero impact on my life. That makes absolutely no difference to me. I really don't care either way. I might have an opinion on security, whatever. The other is I work at CVS making $8 an hour, and this guy over here is saying, I deserve to get paid $16 an hour. Which one do you think I'm going to go get? Obviously, there's one issue that more people are going to care about. So
right. So by nature, there's one, we care about things that affect us personally. But what I'm arguing is that people should, it is, for humanity's sake, it is important for us to care about these things as well that don't affect us personally, that affect other human beings that might not be have any connection to us.
But that's not human nature, and I'm talking about a realistic, pragmatic strategy to win back Congress
right.
in 2 years. It's not going to be talking about Syrian refugees.
Right, so, imagine like a preacher at a pulpit. What are they going to be talking about? Are they going to be talking about how to get a job or minimum wage issues? Or are they going to be talking about, fixing or rectifying the flaws in human nature? That's what I'm talking about. By nature, everyone is tribal.
So I'm imagining a black preacher at the pulpit making a speech to his congregation. I don't think he's talking about humanity and Syrian refugees. I think he's talking about we as a people need to improve our lives. We need a opportunity to better ourselves. And Bernie Sanders is giving us that opportunity, doubling your salary,
yeah, sure.
allowing you to take care of your family, your community.
I'm not arguing against what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
That's important, but I'm saying this is also important.
Everything is important. I'm not saying it's not important,
yeah.
But I'm just saying that one would have a way bigger impact than the other, in my opinion.
What do you think? Anwar, tiebreaker.
I think you got to go after everything.
Everything.
But you can't go after everything equally. Like, if you need to focus on one,
there's no way for you to break down your life and say, okay, I'm going to spend 55% of it on this issue,
mm-hmm.
15% of it on
yeah.
this issue. You address things as they come.
Okay, so look at your like Facebook profile, for example.
Yeah, I'm doing it
like,
all wrong.
What are we doing? All of, and I'm including myself in this, all of our posts almost exclusively have to do with Muslim issues, right? But imagine if instead of that, we focused on talking about minimum wage or how Republican Party is not Christian or, you know, whatever, you know, other issues that might have a broader appeal. Do you think that that would have more of an impact? More people would care and listen to that?
I tell you one thing, though. I've had a lot of friends reach out to me on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And voice their concern. People who are white, Christians,
non-Muslim,
as
well.
Because they see the panic
in
the number of things that I'm posting and the type of things that I'm posting.
Right.
And they're saying, like, look, man, like, I understand, and I really, I'm praying for you, and I hope everything works out, and I'm with you. And they also start posting things like that. So, I mean, there's something to be said for what Saqib is saying, too. But I also agree with you that we need to be, and right now we're just reacting to something that just happened.
This is
a crisis of sorts, and when the next crisis comes, we'll react to that one. But we got to be sure that if it doesn't affect us, that we're still just as adamant about it at that time as we are now.
That being said,
I see it.
More calls, please.
Sure.
Until next time.